Welcome to session 105, Legal Update, Top 10 Legal Developments in Bioethics. And the main big objective in this session is to review legislative, judicial, and regulatory events impacting bioethics over the past year or so. This is about the fourth time that we've had this session in this format, and participation's usually been pretty high, and the feedback's been pretty positive, so hopefully we'll continue that today. I'm Thaddeus Pope. I'm the director of the Health Law Institute at Hamline University, and we'll hear from our panelists in turn and then have question and answers starting just after 2 o'clock until the end of the session at 2:30. So we'll proceed in this order. On your far right, Ali Shalawat, who's a professor and associate dean at Albany Law School. And then second, on your far left, Amy Campbell, who's an assistant professor of bioethics and humanities at SUNY Upstate Medical University. And then third, Art Dersey, who's a professor of bioethics, medical humanities, and emergency medicine, and the director of the Center for Bioethics and Medical Humanities at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Okay, hello. I don't think that any of you will be surprised that in a session on top 10 legal developments in bioethics for 2012, we're going to start with health reform. The Supreme Court, as you all know, handed down a decision for the for a little visual aid. This is the decision, 194 pages. It's massive. I'm going to talk with you about what it says. I won't get into it in detail, obviously, but some of the I'm going to talk about three specific developments around healthcare. First of all, it was a bad year for broccoli. It was an important year for tax and spending, and a very interesting year for birth control. So the decision itself is called the National Federation of Independent Businesses versus Sebelius. It was a decision in which the ACA, Obamacare, PPACA, whatever you want to call it, came very close to being struck down in its entirety. Just to give you a little bit of background, the Affordable Care Act is a massive act that is designed to expand access to healthcare coverage, to control healthcare costs, and improve healthcare delivery systems. Since the day it was passed, it's been controversial. It was controversial before it was passed. It is a massive act that has many, many moving pieces. It makes preventive care free. It makes insurance available to individuals and small businesses through healthcare exchanges. It provides premium and cost-sharing subsidies to make insurance affordable through the exchanges. It requires individuals to have coverage or pay a penalty slash tax. We'll get there. Requires some employers, the big ones, to offer coverage, and requires other employers to pay or play. It provides tax breaks to small employers that choose voluntarily to provide insurance. The act intended to expand Medicaid dramatically. We'll see how that plays out after the decision. It creates or will create an essential health benefits package that will be defined as time goes on. It requires coverage for adult children until the age of 28. It eliminates pre-existing conditions, exemptions, and lifetime caps on insurance. So it does all these things, but those who are opposed to it immediately filed suit. In fact, on the day that President Obama signed it into law, the first lawsuit was filed. It was a lawsuit from Florida. It was followed on by several other lawsuits by other states. 26 states sued to strike down Obamacare. The Supreme Court eventually decided to hear some of the cases, the Florida case and the NCIB case. The case presented three issues. The first one was about the mandate, what in the law is called the shared responsibility clause. The mandate says that everyone has to have health insurance. If you don't get health insurance either through Medicaid or through your insurer, you have to buy health insurance. There are exemptions for low-income folks. The mandate does not apply to them. in terms of the details of the mandate, and it will go into effect in 2014. With an individual, the penalty is $95 for an adult who does not have health insurance. It's $47.50 per child, and up to $285 for a family. The $95 penalty increases to $325 in 2015 and $695 for 2016 and beyond. So the first question presented was, is this mandate legal? Did the Congress have the power does the Congress have the power to impose the mandate? Three different clauses of the Constitution at issue. The second question was about the Medicaid expansion that was built into the Act. So Medicaid, as you probably know, is a state-federal program. It's a states can voluntarily decide to join and participate in Medicaid. Those that decide to participate in Medicaid must follow the federal rules. The ACA would have changed the rules for participation in the Medicaid program. It would have expanded the pool. And it may still, for at least in some states, it may expand the pool of Medicaid-eligible folks by making more people eligible, changing the eligibility line. The way it currently works, many states do not cover adults who have no dependents, and many states do not cover parents at the same rate that they cover kids. So for adults, the Medicaid benefits are either non-existent or lower. The ACA would have made a rule that said if you're going to participate in the program, you various states need to raise those limits to 133% of the federal poverty line, meaning that anyone who is an individual who makes $14,856 per year or less would be eligible for Medicaid. Any family of four that makes $30,657 per year or less would be eligible for Medicaid. The way that the Act was written, there was a carrot and a stick. The carrot is that the feds say, we think this is essential. We will pay 100% of the cost of the expansion in 2014. That amount that the feds would cover was going to be decreased to 90% in through 2020 and beyond. So states would have to pay 10% of the cost of the expansion ultimately in 2020. The stick is, and a lot of the case turn on this, is that the states that don't expand Medicaid under the ACA guidelines would lose all of their Medicaid funds. So they would no longer be eligible for Medicaid. And the final issue that was presented is the question of severability, whether if one part of the Act falls, does the whole thing fall? I got this huge decision. You should see the statute. It's 900 pages. Does the whole thing fall if one piece is unconstitutional? So the focus as the case made its way up to the Supreme Court was on the Commerce Clause and whether it would sustain the mandate, or this is the battle of broccoli. Broccoli's never had so much press as it did this year. Why is that? What in the world does it have to do with health reform? Well, the commerce power is a constitutional provision that supports most of what Congress does. It's really broad. It allows Congress to regulate all kinds of things, anything that affects interstate commerce. And that's virtually anything, including the Supreme Court has said, when a private farmer grows wheat for his own personal consumption, that because that person takes himself out of the market, that affects interstate commerce, that private farmer's actions can be regulated by Congress under the Commerce Clause. And so when this theory started coming out, Randy Barnett and others started saying the Commerce Clause really doesn't support the mandate. The mandate is regulating inactivity, a decision to not participate in the market. And that if Congress can do what it's doing with the mandate and require people to buy health insurance, Congress can go ahead and make people eat buy broccoli. buying broccoli is good for the public health. That's what health insurance is about. All the reasons that apply to making people buy health insurance are the same. It's the same kind of impact in the market if you don't buy broccoli. And when the theory first came out, law professors shook their head. Many law professors shook their heads and said, "This seems really outrageous. Commerce power is incredibly broad. It's never been limited in this way." The law professors were really wrong. The argument had teeth. Everyone was focused on the Commerce Clause. What's going to happen when the case comes down? So the case comes down, and this chart takes you through the count of judges on each piece. So the first piece was a threshold question that was presented, whether or not the case was ripe for review. So there is a statute that applies to taxes that says you can't challenge the constitutionality of a tax until it's been levied against someone, until someone has been assessed that tax. All of the judges agreed that for purposes of the Anti-Injunction Act, the mandate was not a tax. The second question was the Commerce Clause question, the broccoli question, the question of whether the mandate exceeds Congress's power. Five judges spent 64 pages writing about why the mandate exceeds Congress's power. Now, this is really interesting for law professors and lawyers because it's dicta. It's what we call dicta. It is unnecessary to the decision. It does not because of the next holding, the holding that the mandate is a constitutional exercise of Congress's power to levy taxes, they didn't even need to get to the Commerce Clause question, but they did. So that's sort of something that's out there. There are five judges that have now said that there's a limitation on the Congress's power under the Commerce Clause, and we will see what meaning that takes on as time goes on. The most surprising, perhaps, and I think certainly the most important of the holdings in the case is the one with respect to the Medicaid expansion. Seven judges, so that included two of the judges that are traditionally in the sort of liberal branch, held that the Medicaid expansion exceeded Congress's power as unconstitutionally coercive. And I'm going to go into a little bit more about why that's so. With 5-4 in a really sort of interesting split, Justice Roberts with some of those judges who said that there was no constitutional infirmity, they said that the remedy to the problem with the Commerce Clause is not to strike down the whole statute, as four of the judges would have done, but to allow the incentives, allow the carrot, make participation voluntary, so get rid of the stick. So with respect to the Commerce Clause holding, Roberts minted a new constitutional doctrine that says that the commerce power does not permit Congress to compel individuals who are not engaged in commerce to purchase an unwanted product. So they bought the argument, the broccoli argument. They talk about the broccoli argument in the decision. Justice Roberts wrote his own decision. There's another unsigned decision. Many people think that Justice Roberts actually had a hand in writing the unsigned decision, too. But Justice Scalia and the other conservative members of the bench all signed on this argument. There was a strong disagreement in Justice Ginsburg's decision. The decision is really interesting in that Ginsburg's decision reads as though it's a true dissent, that she's not joining in the majority on anything. And the dissent, which is an unsigned joint dissent, which is pretty unusual, refers very often to Ginsburg's dissent. And it's not a dissent, it's an opinion. Now, that sounds confusing. People are shaking their heads. What that means is somebody flipped and it was Justice Roberts. The case was decided the other way. It is fairly clear in reading through the dissenting opinion that it was written as a majority opinion, and Justice Ginsburg's opinion was written as the dissent. And that is something that was fairly obvious on first read, but it's also been confirmed by leaks from the court, which is somewhat unusual. But in any event, Justice Ginsburg writes a passionate rebuttal to the argument that the mandate violates the commerce power. She says it's irrational to say that the decision to forego health care does not affect interstate commerce. She talks about far-reaching effects of those who get their health care without insurance and the cost shifting that goes on to those who have insurance. The decision to forego insurance, she says, is hardly inconsequential or equivalent to doing nothing. She also goes on and on about the broccoli horrible and contests the notion that the market for health care is the same as the market for broccoli. She says that, you know, no one ever has to buy broccoli. You have to buy health care. And if someone does want to buy a car or has a craving for broccoli, she will be obliged to pay at the counter before receiving the vehicle or nourishment. She will get no free ride or food at the expense of another consumer forced to pay an inflated price. She also addressed sort of the slippery slope argument and reasoning that Justice Roberts uses, where he says if we can do this, we're going to start having these broccoli mandates. And she points out that the Commerce Clause would clearly allow the federal government to prohibit the sale of broccoli, or she says, more likely, you know, maybe it would be red meat or fish and dairy products, and effectively creating a land where we can only eat vegetables. Yet no one would offer, this is a quote, the hypothetical and unreal possibility of a vegetarian state as a credible reason to deny the Congress the authority ever to ban the possession and sale of heroin. The Chief Justice accepts just such specious logic when he cites the broccoli horrible as a reason to deny Congress the power to pass the individual mandate. So much strong language. None of it really mattered in the end because the mandate is a tax, has a tax. The fee, says Justice Roberts, looks like a tax. It acts like a tax. And so the fact that Congress went out of its way to call it a penalty and not a tax doesn't undermine the ability of Congress to exercise that power to collect taxes. So the bottom line, says Justice Roberts, is that the shared responsibility payment, the mandate, may be for constitutional purposes, be considered a tax, not a penalty. First, the amount due will be far less than the price of insurance, and by statute, it can never be more. Second, the individual mandate contains no scienter requirement. Third, the payment is collected solely by the IRS through normal means of taxation. So, after all that, the mandate stands. But the Medicaid expansion does not, at least not entirely. The Medicaid expansion, said the majority, goes too far. And this is the first time ever that the Supreme Court has found that Congress has abused its spending power. So with Justices Breyer and Kagan, two of the traditionally liberal justices, and the four traditionally conservative judges, Roberts wrote, Congress may use its spending power to create incentives for states to act in accordance with federal policies, but when the pressure turns to compulsion, the legislation runs contrary to our system of federalism. So basically, this kind of you're going to, if states, if you're going to participate in Medicare, you have to expand the way that we say, or you lose all of your Medicaid, your ability to participate in Medicare, is that's an offer they can't refuse. It's a shifting kind, not merely in degree. It's a gun to the head, and it's not okay. Often when the court enunciates, makes a finding like this, it will enunciate a rule to tell us when something is encouragement, which is permissible, and something is coercion, which is not. In this case, the Supreme Court expressly declined to not draw such a line. It is enough for today, they said, that wherever the line may be, this statute is surely beyond it. Congress may not simply conscript state agencies into the national bureaucratic army. So the Supreme Court has spoken. Now what? Some of the provisions have gone into effect. Preventive care, much preventive care is available for free. Adult kids are on their parents' health insurance. Pre-existing conditions are not reasons for exclusion for children, and that will continue to grow. Consumers are receiving rebates from insurance companies that have administrative costs that are too high. So some of those things are already happening. If President Obama is reelected, the mandate will go into effect in 2014. State exchanges need to be up and running at that time. Some states, but not most states, have begun to put together their exchanges. Many put that off until the Supreme Court decision was going on, and some are going to choose to not create exchanges. The numbers shift, but there are at least 7 states that have declared that they're not going to create state exchanges, and their citizens will have to buy their insurance from exchanges created by the federal government. That's one scenario. Another scenario is that Governor Romney is elected, and he vowed to repeal Obamacare on day one. I'm not sure that that is possible. I don't think that it can be done in one day. But I think it's very possible and very likely that we will see, if he is elected president, we will see real efforts and probably some success in repealing most of this statute. So you have to sort of wait for a couple of weeks to have an idea of what is going to happen. Even if President Obama is elected and the law is implemented in full, you're still going to see Republicans in the Congress and those others who oppose Obamacare looking for continued attempts to block implementation through the budget process. Lots of these provisions are sort of a promise for funding, and it hasn't been funded yet, and so there will be attempts to block health reform through the budget process. So that's a lot of what's going on. There is still the question of contraceptive coverage, and that's the last thing that I'm going to talk with you about today. So as of August 2012, private health insurance plans were required to provide free contraception, no cost, no copays for any kind of contraception. Reason is it was determined to be part of women's preventive care, which is provided for in the Act. The EEOC has ruled that employers who fail to cover contraception when it covers other prescription drugs commit a form of sex discrimination under Title VII. So there's a lot of support for this, the statutory obligation to provide contraception through health insurance plans. But the Obama administration, HHS, made a rule and provided a religious exemption. It is something that is causing lots of consternation on both sides of the debate. So religious employers are exempt from the contraception mandate. Mm-hmm. A religious employer is defined as an employer that has inculcation of religious values as a purpose, primarily employs people who share its religious tenets, primarily serves people who share its tenets, and is recognized as a church under existing law, under the IRS code and whatnot, as a nonprofit. So houses of worship, clergy members, they're exempt. They do not have to provide coverage. Where this gets contentious is about Catholic hospitals and Catholic charities, and where you've got religious organizations that are doing things other than being houses of worship. There are 30 lawsuits pending challenging the religious exemption. Most of them, but not all of them, are brought by the churches. They said that this is a violation of their First Amendment rights to freely exercise their religion, that by participating in a plan and providing coverage to their employees in a plan that covers contraceptions, which violates their religious tenets, is something that the government cannot make them do. These suits have been wholly unsuccessful in terms of striking down this mandate. There have been a couple of state court cases. The states did this long before the feds did. Some of the states, New York and Ohio, did this. And the courts, they went to the top courts in those states, and those courts said that this is a generally applicable law. It's fair, and it does not violate First Amendment rights of these institutions. I believe these cases are going to go to the Supreme Court, and I don't think that we can assume that based on what the states and the lower courts have done, that it won't be given serious consideration. So that is something to watch in health reform, and that's all I have for now. I'm happy to take questions later on. What's up next? I'm going to get out of there. Who's going to help me?
You! You can clap. That's a tour de force. All right, I'm glad that not everyone has left, though. Because I'm sure that everyone's like, okay, I heard about health care reform, we can leave now. There are some other things to talk about. I have the pleasure of talking about the 4th, 5th, and 6th top 10 legal developments. I'm sure you've been waiting in anticipation like you have for iPhones, versions 4 or 5, and I'm sure 6 will be right around the corner. My interest really shifts things more to what's happening at the state and local level. As you know, that's where the rubber hits the road on a lot of these kinds of issues. I'm particularly interested in how governments and the regulations and laws are trying to influence behaviors and discussion that happens between physicians and patients. So that's what I will be addressing. First up, doctor-patient relationship. If you can see that might be an overly empathetic physician. I don't know if you need to go to that length to sympathize with your patient. But first up, sort of a grab bag of states that I've been looking at. This is just my dream. I wish this is where I was working on these. Docs v. Glocks. In Florida, you may have heard about this law. It was the Firearm Owners Privacy Act. That was signed by Governor Rick Scott in Florida in June of 2011. What it did was it said that healthcare providers and healthcare facilities couldn't put any information on gun ownership into a medical record. It also said that healthcare professionals shouldn't discuss, bring up gun ownership with their patients unless it was seen as highly relevant to patient care or perhaps a safety concern, safety of the patient or maybe family members. But it really did limit. They said that the reasoning behind it was that there were anecdotal reports of physicians turning away patients if they did have guns. Pediatricians, wanted to ask about this of parents, and it was seen as an anti-discrimination law. Physicians actually weren't too happy about it, and they brought suit. We don't often hear that. Doctors. It wasn't lawyers suing. This was doctors suing. They brought suit saying that it was on a First Amendment ground, really, that this chilled speech. And in June of 2012, this year, the U.S. District Court of Florida and Southern District of Florida, Judge Cook sided with the physicians and enjoined the law, saying that it did chill speech. It did interfere with the discussion that should be able to happen in that professional sort of doctor-patient relationship, and that there was technical reasons, there was unbiased information that might happen when we discuss gun ownership, and this law sort of went afoul of that. I should mention that the state has indicated its intent to appeal, so we'll see what happens with Docs v. Glocks. But that's one way. In this instance, they were trying to say, Docs, be careful what you say. Moving on to Texas, that is very hard to read, but it says last vegan pizza for 300 and some miles or whatever. I know. Anyway, getting back to abortion, you couldn't really have watched any news and not heard about various things happening with abortion or birth control or family planning this year. Some of these, unlike the last example I had, are really we want doctors to not talk about certain things, or we want them to talk about certain things. But in the first instance, you probably have heard about Texas. The Texas Women's Health Program was created in 2005, and it serves 130,000 low-income women in Texas. It's funded by federal and state funds. For every $9 the federal spends, Texas contributes $1. And it's about giving family planning exams, tests, contraception counseling, but it is not to be at all around abortion or abortion counseling. Seemed okay. 2011, it was reauthorized, and the Department of Health decided that they were going to define more precisely some of the terms, however, and mentioned that it couldn't go, none of these funds could be used by entities that also promoted or affiliated themselves in any way with something associated with abortion. Basically, what this did was it targeted the Planned Parenthood affiliates. 40% of the patients served through this Texas Health Women's Program see Planned Parenthood providers or affiliates for these services. So it had a really dramatic effect on the access to some of this that could happen. So, again, there was a lawsuit. The district court, and it was by the Planned Parenthood affiliates, in this instance saying that this law violated, or this reinterpretation, shall we say, of the law, violated their right to affiliate, to promote what they thought was right. They could affiliate with Planned Parenthood or whatever. They could use the insignia. And so it had a chilling effect or a sort of an unconstitutional effect. The district court sided with them, but the Fifth Circuit actually vacated that decision and remanded it to the lower court. And basically they said, Texas gets to do what it wants with its money. And if it wants to support certain speech or, you know, suppress certain speech, it gets to do that. And the federal government, in light of this, has said that they are considering pulling their money from the program, which you might recall I said $9 versus $1. That would have a serious effect on the ability of Texas to serve. You also, though, probably have heard about Virginia and ultrasound and interesting approaches to ultrasound, shall we say. But in March of this year, the governor signed off on, of Virginia, Governor McConnell, signed off on an ultrasound bill which requires a abdominal ultrasound before someone has an abortion. And there's a waiting period that's implemented that if someone lives within 100 miles of a clinic where they're going to get the abortion, they have to have a 24-hour, this has happened 24 hours before the abortion. If they're greater than 100 miles from the clinic, it has to happen 2 hours before. But it was seen that this is information, so we say, we want to see in this kind of relationship that's happening. This had raised a lot of discussion and debate, and they backed off on a requirement of vaginal ultrasound at this point, but that's, we'll see what other states are doing. Louisiana and Arizona passed similar laws. There were other proposed in 2012, and I think stay tuned to see if more of this happens. Really, this is a trend. I know Professor Ouellette mentioned what's going on with the state insurance exchanges and covering abortion, but we do see a trend not just on access, but on sort of that relationship and trying to inform or influence the kind of discussion that happens, as well as who funds it. Just in case you know, I have to get New York in there. I'm from New York. I'm actually from the wonderful green part, but New York City is what people think of when they think of New York. And if you hadn't heard, but the illustrious New York Post, it came to light in September of this year, just recently, that the City Department of Education is now providing emergency contraception in 13 high schools, as well as birth control and Depo-Provera, to any high school students, in part because it was seen, I just want to make sure, I think it's important to get our facts right, but 28% of the city youth as they enter ninth grade, are already sexually active. So there's certainly, there's a sexual activity issue. 7,000 girls under the age of 17 became pregnant in 2011. 64% of those had an abortion. Of those who didn't, a lot of them dropped out. So there definitely is a public health issue, an educational issue, a women's health issue going on. And so what the city is doing in response is providing not just condoms, but emergency contraception. There is a parental opt-out, so it's kind of like kids get to do it without permission, although parents can opt out. A letter goes home and they can opt out. 1 to 2% of parents in each school so far have declined or opted out of the program. Some parents are all for it. As you can imagine, some parents never even knew it happened. They didn't get the letter. They never saw the letter. So the lawyer in me has probably a little bit of concern about the opt-out approach, but you can understand maybe where some of the public health concerns might be coming from. Switching gears really quickly to the empowered patient, just to let you know, if you're interested in this, there's a conference coming up in California. Doesn't that look pretty? I don't know. I'm free to speak at that. But the informed patient, really what's happening here is we want to have a patient be more involved in the decision-making and really engage in that decision-making. And how we get to that through the law can help support that by having more information sort of be shared with patients, by having them have more access to information, and I'll talk a moment about the future. For more information, for an example, again, is from New York State. Governor Cuomo, in July of this year, signed the breast density law. It was passed unanimously in the New York State legislature, and if any of you from New York, you know how amazing that actually is. I guess people go breasts. But breast, what's interesting is it says that if anyone has, if density, the breast density when there's a mammography looks, you know, if it's dense, a letter, and there's specific language, has to go to the patient telling them of this density, and that could be a risk sign for breast cancer, and that they should follow up with their physician for additional screening. So when this was announced, it said it was to empower women to be able to engage more in their care. Some physicians, among others, have raised some concerns that do we know that exams are effective at detecting risk? And is this also creating a new liability standard for radiologists? But that did pass fairly easily. Access to information, briefly, on test results. You may have heard this, but there are proposals now. HIPAA, for many years, has allowed patients to access their medical records, even if it's kind of complicated to actually try to do that. There are new proposals that have just come forward to change CLIA, the Clinical Laboratory Improvement Amendments, to allow patients not only to have access to that, but to actually directly get their test results. So they'd have 30 days, a lab would have 30 days to comply, but they could write the lab and actually get your results. If you've been waiting before for a physician to call and give you results, you can sympathize with patients wanting to get the information themselves, although this does raise a concern about what do they do with that information. But that's sort of on the stage. Several states allow this already, so it really would sort of unify that. On medical records, briefly, you may have heard of the High Tech Act of 2009, but basically suffice it to say there's a big push and there are financial incentives to do this, to move towards electronic health records. As of 2011, 34% of the doctors surveyed were using electronic health records, so it's starting to have some effect. Stage one was really to try to get docs, to get these things online. Stage two, and this was just requirements were just announced in August of 2012 from the Department of Health and Human Services as well as CMS, announcing that the stage two requirements, they sort of listed what they're going to be, but the focus there is really to allow patients to access records via online, secure online portals. So this is where, again, we see the patient role coming in a bit more on this. I'll talk a little bit more about an interesting thing on health records in a moment, but the future really for me is that you can see that there will be a push to have more results, more tests. Like there's a new HIV test that was just approved, in-home test where you can get your own results. That's seen as positive. But there is a push. New patients can now get genetic sequences for patients to get a lot more information for individuals. And we'll see what happens with that. Briefly, on electronic health records, there was a study that just came out, Open Notes Studies. I encourage you to look in Annals if you're interested. But really what this is sort of showing that patients want the records. Physicians might tweak what they put in the records a bit when this happens. But it really does sort of, it's changing the scope of care. Just fears around that. If we push things online, there is definitely a concern that what about patients who don't have access, if they're older, lower income populations, maybe certain racial or ethnicities? What if they can't access online in the same way? What's the privacy? Is this changing the physician relationship with their patients in some way? Just briefly, my last point is really a nudge on sort of public behavior. If you've been to this talk lately, you know I can't not end anything I talk about without talking about obesity, because I like to ruin your day for you. So when you go to eat tonight, you will have this in your mind. But we are a nation that's struggling a bit with obesity. And New York City, as you will see, is not unique in this, but certainly has, if you look at the darker colors there, that's where there is a lot of obesity. So it's had its own sort of struggles. Costs. I've given this information before, but costs are pretty high, and in New York State, they're very high. We're the second highest in terms of our outlay for obesity-related expenditures. So leading everything always ends up in New York City, although for me, at 4 o'clock, I will be cheering that way because I'm not from... Now I don't care. Now I'm going to get bad reviews, and I don't care. But what Bloomberg... You probably have heard about this, but Mayor Bloomberg proposed, and it was recently... accepted that we're drinking too much of our sort of sugary beverages and too much caloric intake. And so what he has proposed is that we will go from, there'll be a 16 floor allowance limit now, and part of it is because he wanted to jumpstart a dialogue, and it also thought that we could save lives. This is in food service establishments that the department regulates. So it's restaurants, it's stadiums, it's food carts. It's not, as we've heard, 7-Eleven or, you know, and you could buy a couple of cups. I mean, there's a billion ways to probably game this. So I'm not sure how effective it is, but it certainly is effective law as a really starting a conversation, although it could also just be New York City is interested in these things. But just really the upshot from this for me is that there sometimes is a problem, and so we think, you know, let's do something about it. And when I'm teaching medical students, they said, we need a law on that, or is there a law on that to tell us what to do? Sometimes we don't want a law. My concern is that sometimes we rush into law and we haven't thought about what's motivating our action, what evidence do we have to suggest what the effectiveness might be, have we thought through the consequences, and particularly beyond economics. First of all, I think economics is a value. I think we have to think of that as not just dollars, cents, but there is a value in economics. But also, are there other values like justice, or are we thinking through those things when states and local governments are acting? So that's it. Thank you. Can you get it?
Good afternoon. I am from the great state of Wisconsin, which is temporarily basking in the national spotlight and will end all too soon for us in about a week and a half. So I'd like to talk about three areas of end of life. The concentrations are going to be advanced care planning and advanced directives and PULSE, physician-assisted suicide, and I'm going to compare what's going on with pain medication to what's going on with medical marijuana nationally. So you know, of course, the consensus that's quite well known, the right to refuse any intervention, the fact that all patients have this right, and that withholding, withdrawing are not homicide or suicide, and courts don't need to be involved. I had on there the Schiavo case, which was full of sound and fury, but pretty much after going through a number of federal trial, appellate, and Supreme Courts, and a refusal of cert by Supreme Court, and state courts of the same level, and executive decisions, It turns out that we are pretty much in agreement with the consensus. That having been said, the consensus is that we have this right to refuse, but that sure, she has the right to die. All she has to do is come out of the coma and ask. And Missouri, the show me state, gets to ask for clear and convincing evidence about this. So one of the more interesting cases in the past year was the Grace Sung-Yun Lee case, which was a woman in hospitalized in Manhasset, Long Island, North Shore Hospital, 28-year-old, she was a bank manager, had brainstem tumor, had radiation chemo, seizures, finally stroke, quadriplegic, terminally ill, but she was conscious, as opposed to the other cases that we've just referred to, and she made a request for withdrawal of the ventilator. Psych eval showed that she had decisional capacity, but her father, a minister, was opposed, said, it's suicide, it's a sin, she's depressed. Daughter's being manipulated by doctors and medication, and a cousin who is related, obviously, to the father, recorded a video asking, are you willing to sign the medical proxy of your father? Patient basically unable to speak, mouth yes twice. So this was actually heard in court. A psychiatrist and social worker testified that she clearly wanted withdrawal of life support. That having been said, as it was being litigated, there was a restraining order from withdrawing. That was lifted, and ultimately the New York Court of Appeals said that she is competent and has the right to have her life-sustaining medical treatment withdrawn. Well, the patient signed a healthcare proxy designating her father as the primary decision-maker. Now, you may say this brings up very interesting issues because, first of all, if she has the capacity to make decisions, why don't they just go ahead and stop life-sustaining medical treatment? It has to do with, I think, a very important insight, and that is the conception of the doctor-patient relationship in the law is this dyadic component in which it's thought each individual is autonomous and can make decisions. Obviously, the patient is in a complex web of familial relationships, culture, the importance of acceding to what her father wants. And ultimately, this case is about the undermining of something that in the legal system would have been fairly straightforward had we accepted what she wanted. Another aspect will be when she becomes non-decisional, will her father be able to be held accountable to perform according to her wishes? And I think the answer is going to be probably not. So just a point of a case that essentially says this is not easy to address. Now, this is the night of the living will, and obviously because of the Patient Self-Determination Act, living wills and powers of attorney for health care were designated. Initially, no evidence that the completion changed the care, but more recently some important evidence that shows that people who actually request limited care and people who actually ask for everything done actually have now care consistent with their preferences. So that was then, this is now, and it's an important change. Also, in the past year, an important study came out showing that advance directives that were specifying limitations in end-of-life care actually were associated with significantly lower levels of Medicare spending in the last 6 months of life in certain areas that were characterized by higher end-of-life care spending. So do advance directives, legislatively crafted solution to this difficult area actually reduce costs? The answer is when costs are very expensive, mainly on the coasts, yes. The answer is it does. In other areas, not so much. A healthcare plan would give seniors the right to choose how they are killed. This is the Onion, which started in Madison, Wisconsin, now a New York institution. You already know that the CMS final rule last year that had planned for some payment for discussion of end-of-life care was out for all of about 4 days because of the blowback in the connection with so-called death panels. So physicians, of course, still can discuss this with patients, just aren't going to get funding for it. One of the solutions to be able to do this is to try to designate, not just on a piece of paper, because an advance directive may not be found easily, but to designate it in some other way, especially for we emergency physicians. It's nice to have some indications beyond trying to get to an advance directive. This is a tattoo that says no code. But the better answer is the PULS paradigm, physician's orders on life-sustaining treatment, which are essentially pre-hospital DNR orders on steroids, specifying what ought to be done, because some decisions are made at the bedside using advanced directives, others are made immediately and emergently. And so there has been a widespread adoption of the PULS paradigm, originally begun in Oregon. They are often colored, bright colored, to be able to be identified easily. And one example is the PULS Act just signed last year by Governor Christie, sponsored, interestingly, by Republicans, administered by the Commissioner of Health and Senior Services. And in New Jersey, the instructions must be adhered to unless the patient gives the physician or healthcare proxy the power to override. That aspect about whether or not physicians must honor this depends upon the state in which the PULS paradigm has been incorporated. Now, the PULS is a pre-hospital DNR order. You don't need a law to be able to have pre-hospital DNR orders on steroids. You merely need to have an EMS, Emergency Medical Systems, medical director recognize it. But if it's a state-legislated form, you will have physician immunity for following the directives, which is a very important thing that physicians and others are interested in having. So 15 states have PULS legislative or administrative rules, and 20 states have programs in development. One interesting case that's come up this year is the DeArmond case in California, where an 18-year-old with brain cancer, she's a dependent adult, mother was the decision maker, and had a California PULS completed by the primary care physician in consultation with an ethicist, with the mother, that indicated do not intubate. Unresponsive, brought to an emergency department, and the mother claims that she told the emergency physician about the PULS and the DNI order, the emergency physician, in essence, she said, doesn't matter, I'm going to intubate her, we're putting her up in the ICU, a very common reaction among emergency physicians unless they have some kind of indication otherwise, ultimately transferred to another Kaiser facility and died. So the suit was filed by the family for damages and injunctive relief to prevent the healthcare center from not following these wishes, alleging that the ED physician knew or should have known about the PULS. And in the California statute authorizing this, it does not apply. First of all, physicians should treat an individual according to their wishes, but Section B, the first section, doesn't apply if the PULS form requires medically ineffective care, futility, or health care contrary to what's generally accepted. And C, a physician may conduct an evaluation of the individual and, if possible, in consultation with an individual, the individual's legally recognized health care decision maker can issue a new order. So the defense, which hasn't been established, may be that the physician made a determination that, in fact, the medical situation did not warrant it. So that's the one side, possible getting in trouble for following PULS. Another aspect of PULS is a new religious objection. So far, this has gone through in all of these states without a problem. However, in the great state of Wisconsin, the five bishops of Wisconsin issued a letter to Catholics saying a PULS form represents opinion for treatments as if they were morally neutral. In fact, they are not. A PULS oversimplifies these decisions and bears the real risk that an indication may be made on it to withhold treatment that, in particular circumstances, might be an act of euthanasia. I think they're talking about passive euthanasia in the classical designation or withdrawal, withholding of life-sustaining medical treatment, which would be ordinary treatment in their view. So the risk is too grave to be acceptable. They list other concerns, but the main one is that it's possible that someone would choose something that would not be in accord with Catholic doctrine. So due to the serious and real threats to the dignity of human life that PULS and other similar documents present, we encourage all Catholics to avoid using such documents, programs, and materials. That essentially is killing anything going forward in the Wisconsin legislature on PULS, simply because I think the state's influence by that denomination is fairly strong. So that is interesting because for the rest of the country, other Catholic bishops have not found this. So this says, according to this Bieber, sometimes it's damned if you do and damned if you don't, you know. All right, physician-assisted suicide. Just a note that in the past year and some, Jack Kevorkian has moved on. States are free to develop laws, thanks to Glucksberg and VACO, and Oregon, Washington have laws due to referenda, Montana as a result of a Supreme Court ruling, and there have been failed efforts in a number of states. Yes, Oregon's lovely, but we're just here for the suicide. Well, I am going to just mention that the physician-assisted suicide experience, the Oregon experience, is well known. Washington and Montana have both laws and and a court decision that allow this. Washington is keeping track of its numbers because Montana is not regulated. There is not the similar care to the reasons that people are choosing this in these states. And in Washington and Oregon tend to be loss of autonomy, activities, and dignity. That says I also do suicides. Boy Scout. Georgia, Supreme Court struck down their assisted suicide law in February 2012 on the basis of free speech and First Amendment rights, basically because the speech acts of advertising or offering assisted suicide services were being restricted. After that was struck down in February, the Georgia legislature passed and the governor signed a law that basically reestablished this without the First Amendment concerns. Massachusetts will be voting very shortly on their own Death with Dignity Act. So it'll be, if it is passed, the first state outside of the West that's going to decide this. An adult Massachusetts resident, terminal illness less than 6 months, pretty much the same requirements, few minor differences between this and Oregon. And the signatures actually exceeded the minimum number for the ballot. The polls look pretty strong. It is most likely going to be passed. Of course, predictions are always difficult, especially about the future. As Yogi Berra said, we'll see. Hawaii, there's a group of physicians who are offering to write prescriptions for physician-assisted suicide and claim to have helped. The numbers in favor of physician-assisted suicide in Hawaii are even greater. We'll see whether or not these result in any litigation. There's at least been one claim that a patient was assisted. So far, no prosecutions. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that in Canada, there is an important case, Carter versus Canada, which has struck down Canada's criminal code on assisted suicide as unconstitutional. There's a one-year moratorium of implementation. The patient for whom this was advocated for died without availing herself of this possibility. We will see. There is a hearing in March 2013 as far as whether or not it will be able to stand. For those of you who know about the Rodriguez case, this is essentially relitigating, using an ALS patient, the same matter that was litigated in the mid-90s, but there may be a different climate. That says, let's see, where should Jerry hurt today? Well, Hippocrates debunked the myth of a deistic cause of pain, but I just want to contrast two things. The sea change, I think, that is occurring with respect to opiates. For many of you who know the history of use of opiates, that physicians were reluctant to prescribe, a number of studies, and these are just some, showed that the perception of risk was much greater by the actions than the actions by regulatory boards. In fact, there were some cases for physicians being disciplined for actually not treating patients' pain adequately. And here's a couple of classical citations about this, Builder and Bergman versus Chin. But into this, as the pendulum was swinging and people were saying you need to be able to attend to people's pain, surprise, narcotics are the most widely prescribed drug in the United States, and just the first line is all that's important. There has been a 400% increase in prescription drug abuse over a decade. So the DEA is interested in this matter and was originally on board. And I just want to point out that about 1 in 1,000 physicians are actually investigated, 1 in 10,000 prosecuted in some way. but they were originally on board with something called the Promoting Pain Relief and Preventing Abuse of Pain Medications Consortium in 2001, but then they retreated from it over a period of years with FAQs, clarifications, and notice of rulemaking that essentially said, you know, we kind of did agree with this, but now we're not so sure, in essence. Finally, they said, nonetheless, you still have the responsibility for adequately addressing people's pain, but we will look at the numbers of the amount and the chronicity of your prescriptions to decide whether or not to prosecute. This is, now don't feel bad if the people in the drugstore look at you funny when you hand them this prescription. So their new approach, instead of prosecuting doctors individually, is now trying to get to the pipeline by addressing the intermediaries who essentially supply the pharmacies with medications from the major manufacturer and putting pressure on there rather than trying to put pressure on individual physicians. And there's some other measures that they've taken, something known as risk evaluation mitigation strategy, which is long story short, for full informed consent about using opioids, trying to reduce the risk. And right now, this is voluntary, but it is not impossible that it will become mandatory for physicians for prescribing narcotics. And there's a group of physicians from fairly august centers that are actually getting on the same bandwagon, saying we've basically gone too far in this direction. So a pendulum swing back. Robbie's Bar and Pain Management Center. Obviously, narcotics are not the only way to deal with pain. Just a note that medical marijuana seems to be something that is expanding with a little bit of tension. The Montana legislature tried to repeal their medical marijuana law. The governor vetoed it, so they just passed a more restrictive law. Bottom line is that there's a referendum in November as far as whether or not they will keep their medical marijuana law. 16 states have these laws. California is running into federal and DEA prosecutions, and the number of dispensaries has been reduced by almost half as a result of these. There's also non-medical marijuana referenda, things not dealing with medical marijuana, but just legalization, regulation, licensing, and the level noted for intoxication for driving that will be on ballots in Washington, Oregon, and Colorado. So not too many Midwest states with medical marijuana laws, although Minnesota has decriminalization. The key to this is that the lightest green colors are medical marijuana. Purely darkest green are ones that have both medical marijuana and decriminalization, and then the mid color is decriminalization. So that's the end of life book club segment on those topics. This says, look, I'm dying, I've got to go. End of life, that was then, because in my day, people died. Nowadays, they just go through long periods of incapacity. This shows you how much I know, and that's not a good attitude for end-of-life care, since the death rate still is one. Sorry I'm late, but it took them about a week to determine I was legally dead. All right, this says, hey, great death, and that actually is what we're interested in from a medical side. And sorry to be so jocular, but bottom line is I'm not really much of a morning person. Thank you.
Okay, so we have three, that's nine, so we've promised to do top 10 legal developments, so I'm just going to do one, medical futility, which would be our 10th. And what I mean by medical futility, quickly, is basically a conflict where the providers think that the appropriate medical plan is comfort measures only, palliative care only, but the surrogate wants to continue life-sustaining medical treatment. Well, Paul Simon famously said that there are 50 ways to leave your lover, right? Drop off the key, get yourself free. But I only have time to give you five ways to resolve a medical futility dispute: prevention, consensus, transfer, surrogate selection, and unilateral action. Prevention. It's obviously better to prevent and avoid a conflict in the first place than to try to fix it after it's already arisen. And we are getting better at this. As Art mentioned, we're doing a lot more and a lot better advanced care planning including a big expansion of Pulsed in a lot of states like Iowa, and even Wisconsin this year. And we have earlier and better end-of-life communication, right? A greater focus on seeking assent rather than consent, right? So, for example, inappropriate options aren't even offered in the first place. Again, conflict avoided. If there is a conflict, if the conflict does arise, the parties usually, most of the time, are able to reach agreement. Only around 5% of conflicts remain intractable. And these are the ones I'm going to focus on. So if you can't resolve the conflict, if you can't reach consensus through mediation, then you can try to transfer the patient to another facility that's willing to provide the treatment that you're not willing to provide, that you think is medically inappropriate. That's usually not possible, but sometimes it is. If you can't transfer the patient, and you can't get consent from the surrogate to your proposed treatment plan, then maybe you can get a new surrogate who will consent to your proposed plan. Right? Surrogates are legally obligated to make decisions in the patient's best, in accordance with the patient's values and preferences, and if not that, then at least in accordance with the patient's best interest. If the surrogate deviates from that job, from that role, then the surrogate can be replaced. The surrogate should be replaced. Just a couple cases. Last year in Minnesota, we had a case. Al Barnes had an advanced directive, clearly declining life-sustaining treatment in the circumstances in which he then found himself. He didn't have capacity. But his wife would not consent to the proposed treatment plan in contravention of his advanced directive. This case actually is more complicated than this. And therefore, since she was contravening the advance directive, the court replaced her with a professional guardian who would and did consent to the clinician's plan. And just last month in Alberta, clinicians determined that comfort measures only were appropriate for baby M, who was in a persistent vegetative state. The parents would not consent, probably, as you can tell from the picture, because they were in police custody, accused of the abuse and neglect that was the reason she was in a persistent vegetative state. Well, allegedly, they haven't been tried yet. And therefore, again, the court determined in Alberta that the parents were not doing their job in making decisions in baby M's best interest. They were replaced. Next week in Hawaii, the court will rule, and I predict, this is a conflict again between the guardian and the patients who are in an advanced directive, predict that the court will say that the guardian does not have the power, the authority, the discretion to contravene the patient's known wishes. That's just a snapshot. Surrogate selection happens all the time, and there are more and more cases in which this is the vehicle for resolving the dispute. Indeed, in Ontario, they have a special tribunal, the Consent and Capacity Board, that regularly does just this, replaces surrogates in medical futility conflicts. But there are limits. For example, clinicians in Toronto determined that life-sustaining treatment is not appropriate for Hassan Rasuli, but they did not go to the Consent and Capacity Board, which is in Ontario. Why? Well, his family's making the decision to continue life-sustaining treatment in accordance with Hassan's Muslim faith. In other words, they're making the same decision that he would have made for himself. In short, they're good surrogates. They won't be replaced. They can't be replaced in the Consent and Capacity Board. So in this situation where you can't replace the surrogate, and that sometimes happens because the surrogates are being good surrogates, it just so happens that you don't like the decision that they're making or that the patient would have made for herself. Well, in that situation, clinicians might want to use the last dispute resolution mechanism, unilateral action, right? And actually, in the Rasuli case in December, the clinicians in Toronto are asking the Supreme Court of Canada for permission to stop life-sustaining treatment without consent, right? They lost at the Ontario Court of Justice, the Ontario Court of Appeals, which says you need consent. If you can't get it and you can't replace the surrogate, then you're stuck. They're asking the Supreme Court of Canada for permission. In the United States, I'm just going to summarize this real quick using a traffic light metaphor, red, green, yellow. And let's just start with yellow because that's descriptive of most of the United States. Right, it's not quite clear if you have a red light or a green light. Basically, it's just unclear whether or not clinicians have a right to stop treatment without consent. And given this uncertainty and given the extreme legal risk averseness of clinicians, they generally cave in and capitulate to surrogate demands. We do have a few green lights in the United States. The main example is, of course, Texas, where Texas law basically says that you, meaning you, the clinician, you may stop life-sustaining treatment for any reason with immunity if your hospital ethics committee agrees. And it's a little bit more than that, but that's basically 98% of it. And it seems pretty effective. It's perceived as effective. And so a lot of other states across the United States have tried to copy, have made some efforts to copy the Texas law in their jurisdiction. None have been successful, so Texas remains unique in having this law. But we'll see in a few weeks, because coming up is the 2013 legislative session in Texas, and there was a lot of legislative activity in the 2007, 2009, and 2011 sessions. So as you can see, this is on the Texas Hospital Association's list of agenda issues, as it is on Texas Right to Life. So we'll see if it lasts. And there's another green light in the United States, and that's that clinicians may refuse, not just for professional reasons, they think it's medically inappropriate, but also for personal conscience-based reasons. And there are a lot of conscience clauses across the United States. A lot of them are focused on the reproductive area, but many are not limited to that context. Most conscience clauses do have a treat till transfer limitation, meaning if you want to refuse a medical service on the basis of conscience, you can't do that until you can stop providing the service once you transfer the patient to somebody else. If you don't transfer, then you can't stop. But some states don't have a treat-till transfer limitation, like Mississippi. And in 2012, what we saw was more states with these more flexible conscience clauses, like Oklahoma had a statute, which, didn't have a treat-till transfer limitation. So finally, there are red lights, right, which basically, again, tell the clinician, you can't stop. If you don't get the surrogate consent to stop, you can't stop, even if you think continued life-sustaining treatment is medically inappropriate. And there have been a lot more red lights over the past few years. New York Family Health Care Decisions Act in 2010 basically put in a red light. This year, in 2012, we had the Idaho Discrimination in Denial of Life-Preserving Treatment Act, which went into effect in July. And this act basically says health care may not be denied if it's directed by the surrogate. Now, there is a futile care exception to that, but it's really narrow. It's only when death is imminent within hours or the denial will not result in death. This is so narrow, it's not going to help you in any real futility dispute that you see. Oklahoma had a bill very, very similar to the one that passed in Idaho. The Oklahoma bill passed the Senate, but it died in the House. Alaska had a bill very similar to the one that is now enacted in Idaho. It was limited to CPR only. It died. So just in sum, I think it's interesting. For years, I had thought that all these yellow states across the United States, yellow light states, were going to start switching into green lights. And in fact, just in 2012, it looks like instead what's happening are the yellow lights are, on balance, moving more toward red lights. Just to make a plug, I track medical futility on my blog, medicalfutility.blogspot.com, and I'm going to put all the slides for all four of us on my web, which is ThaddeusPope.com/ASBH, so that we'll get those up there for you. So I think there's microphones in the center aisle here, so please ask questions of the four of us. Thank you.
Let me say it's very nice to hear Canadian cases being decided along with your American judgments. Let me just a quick update and correction on the presentation of the Carter case in British Columbia. Carter case was not initially an ALS case. It was brought forward by the BC Civil Liberties Union primarily on libertarian grounds. In amended documents, it was joined by Taylor, a patient with ALS, which allowed them to go for expedited hearing and bring in a doctor who, while never having seen the person, said he would still be willing to commit euthanasia. And as you know, she died. That is now, that BC Supreme Court is our regional court. That is now moving on appeal to the federal Supreme Court and will probably be heard in 2013. More importantly, however, is the case being heard now in Quebec, the LeBlanc case, which is legally much tighter and probably legally will have more importance than precedent, depending on its decision. It's heard in December, and those two will be bundled together, perhaps even with Rizzulli that you mentioned, in futility, probably in the Supreme Court sessions of 2013 or 14. So it's important to separate out the ALS from the Carter case and the political from, in fact, the medical, which have been going forward both in Ontario and in Quebec and in that other, oh yeah, British Columbia, as it moves forward. And these will, they are watching very carefully what's happening in your legal system, and much of what is being argued in the courts has a precedential basis, informational basis on some of the stuff which has happened in the American courts.
So I just want to say thank you. I had both wanted to, I was thinking about not mentioning that case, and then I thought it was really important to do so. And I apologize, the slide did have the fact that it was brought on the, from the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association. And I realized that, thank you very much for clarifying and telling us more about what's going on.
I'm sorry, yeah, I should say also that I'm a consultant for the Crown in these cases. So I've been fairly involved with them.
Thank you.
I'm starting to think that I'm at the Canadian Bioethics Society meeting, and I might have to check where I am, really. I thought these presentations were fantastic, and an underlying thread to them, in my mind, is a question about what efforts are being made to bring about policy, evidence-based policies or evidence-based legislations and court decisions. And so I just wanted to open up and hear some of your thoughts on that perspective, on that question.
I'll just make a quick comment, and then I think that generally the courts are not a good place for this, because, and this is one of those received law school sorts of things, that the courts don't have the capacity to hold hearings and gather the sorts of evidence in a careful and systematic way that a legislature can. Okay, so generally courts aren't going to really make good evidence-based decisions. Actually, the Carter case, though, is an exception. That's an awesome, awesome decision that she wrote there. I mean, she does a careful, what is it, like 200 pages long. That's an exception. But the thing is, in bioethics, these issues are politically hot, and the legislatures aren't touching it. And so if we're ever going to have any public discourse on some of these issues, the courts have to pick it up. And so it's either nothing or something that's less than ideally evidence-based.
Just briefly... I think the courts do have a role, though. If you read the, I mentioned the Dox v. Glox case. If you read Judge Moore's opinion, she basically says, you came to us with anecdotes. Where is data that shows that this is actually happening in doctors' offices, that people are actually being discriminated against, that Second Amendment rights are being violated? And she really called to task. And so you could see that judges could encourage, or judge law could encourage, certainly some of this discussion. You also are starting to see it a lot with regulations or with policy. So not the judge law, but if you go to law, statutes or regulations that really are wanting to see more evidence. My only caveat there is that who defines what evidence, what matters with that evidence, how it's, you know, given weight. And so there's promise, but I don't think we should think that evidence will be what cures all, you know, that ails us.
Hi, thank you for a very terrific presentation. On the medical futility conflict, practice in New York, wonder if we could take this a step further. There's a proliferation lately of futility policies in red light states. Wonder if anyone can comment on whether those policies, while they don't change the law, if anyone has knowledge of whether they give physicians more courage or health systems more courage under the red light law, or whether futility policies have any effect. Does anyone have anything to say about that?
So I'm happy to say that we live in a yellow state without any particular law on the subject, but our institution does have a policy which it rarely invokes but has invoked over the years, and we also have published it in a legal textbook, and it's available on the web. A few other hospitals have adopted it as well. I do think having a policy is helpful for the physicians who are thinking about using reasons of futility to stop treatment, because bottom line is they ask, so if I'm going to do this, you know, like, who stands behind me? If your hospital or your healthcare institution has no policy on this, then it's merely the standard of care, and, you know, it depends upon what that physician views as that. That having been said, before we instituted this policy, we brought it to our medical executive committee, and I was amazed to find out that one physician said, why would we ever have a futility policy? We're the last best hope of southeastern Wisconsin. Anybody should be able to get anything here that could possibly help. And there are some famous statements in accord with that from some other physicians. One other physician said, whoa, I think you just have to negotiate it with each and every family, and it's totally dependent upon the individual practitioner, what they're willing to do, and, you know, how they work it out. And the last one said, well, I'm a surgeon, and if they're not a surgical candidate, that's futility, and I don't need a second opinion, and I don't need the offer of transfer. I just determined we're not going to do it, and we don't do it. I'm a licensed physician. It's according to our standard of care. So it was interesting that even in that context, to find out that people realized that they had different opinions and that maybe a policy that applied to all would be a good idea. But it is rarely used, and it's mostly used with respect to resuscitation, because a number of people want, quotes, everything done, and there are circumstances in which it won't help. But I don't know nationally how other groups have fared.
I would just say real quick that in your estimate, red light states, so having a futility policy, where you actually don't have, the law is clear that you don't have the right to withdraw. That said, I think it's still useful to have a futility policy, and the evidence, there's published evidence on this, that since most of the time, again, consensus is reached, that the futility policy may not help you in the intractable cases, because it's not going to provide you, if you really think you're going to get sued, you can't hold up your futility. I mean, you can, but it's not going to account for much. But it's very still useful to have the futility policy, because it outlines a dispute resolution process that would avoid the need to take unilateral action. And that's the value, is in the 95% of the cases.
I'm Bill Andrick. My question is also about futility policies, and actually to you, Mr. Pope. Are you familiar, and you may not be, with the specifics of California Probate Code, which basically states that a physician has, there's three sections, but combined they state that a physician has no civil or criminal liability for providing ineffective treatment. They don't use the word futility, thank God. I call it the F word, actually. But for ineffective treatment. Go along with actually hospital policy and generally accepted standards within the community. Are you familiar with that probate? My question is, and we're having the same problem, we do use futility policies, or what we call non-beneficial policies, all the time. And in fact, the process doesn't always have to go to the unilateral removal of the treatment. But my question is, our physicians still don't believe it. Do you feel that that probate code law in California, along with a policy, along with an ethics committee, which is also involved in these, do you think that does give them the appropriate criminal and civil liabilities? And why not?
So California, and it's worth mentioning that California law is rather common. I mean, in other words, very similar language, because California basically adopted the Uniform Health Care Citizens Act, as did Delaware, Maine, Alaska, and a lot of other states. So basically, in Probate Code 4740, right? You do have criminal, civil, and disciplinary immunity if you're refusing something that is contrary to generally accepted healthcare standards. Here's why it's not the safe harbor that it purports to be. There aren't any generally accepted healthcare standards. Variability in end of life medicine is enormous, that where exactly the scope and the boundaries of the safe harbor are is very, very uncertain. So if somebody, you know, if you got clinical practice guidelines, something, then you would know, oh, this applies. We could link this into the probate code. But as it is, people dialysize people in PVS. I mean, in other words, so the standard of care is actually to
is to do the thing that you don't want to do. And people are continually reinforcing and creating the very standard of care that they don't want to comply with.
My question, though, is does a hospital policy accepted by the medical staff, does that not, will that not be interpreted as standard of care?
I mean, we could talk later. I mean, basically, I mean, the thing is, that there's a whole idea of what the statute refers to the standard of care, and a hospital can't create its own standard of care. I mean, maybe like 50 years ago, there used to be something called the locality rule, where the standard of care for a physician was the locality. You'd look to just Los Angeles. But now it's a nationwide standard of care. So I think the idea that your policy actually creates your own standard of care flies in the way in which that works.
I think I have a general question from a non-legal practitioner about dicta. It's my understanding that dicta is fun for law school professors and fun for people who like to read the tea leaves about what might happen later, but really has no impact on any future decisions. First of all, is that correct? And then secondly, the way the dicta in the Affordable Care Act, specifically the part about the Commerce Clause, looks is it actually looks to me, again, as a non-practitioner, as it was written as part of the majority opinion, and then when the tax part flipped, it became dicta and they just left it in anyway. Is that also your reading?
It is. And so the dicta, I mean, there are cases it's in sort of comparable situations that look back at writing where it wasn't essential to the holding, and they say, well, it was mere dicta. But when we say mere dicta, it usually means you didn't think about it very much. I mean, I think that it will be very interesting to see what the court does with the next Commerce Clause action. You know, it's announced a new rule. You have five judges, you know, telling everyone what the future is going to be on a Commerce Clause case. Now, there aren't a lot of laws that are like the healthcare mandate, so you know, whether it does anything or not. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's right, and we're all lawyers, so other people have other understandings. But dicta is mere dicta. It's just unnecessary to the decision. It doesn't carry weight. We don't have to follow it. It doesn't have precedential value. But in this case, it's a lot of dicta.
Yeah.
So I have a question and a statement. First is a statement, which is a shameless plug. So tomorrow we're doing a panel specifically on this issue of national guidelines for exactly what we're talking about in terms of unilateral decision making. And to that end, I actually wanted to ask the panel your thoughts when we start talking about red states and yellow states. So the current national guidelines allow for unilateral withdrawal if it falls under a not medically indicated category. But the newer guidelines are probably going to go beyond that and actually look at not medically advisable as well, which is sort of where we get into this gray area of PVS and minimally conscious and some of these other things. And Professor Pope, you talked briefly about how institutional guidelines don't give you that much, but national guidelines might be different. And so what I'm wondering is, what's the effect of the current, somewhat limited national guidelines, and what might be the effect of more robust national guidelines put out by the two major critical care societies? And might that influence the law, or how would that affect individual practitioners in yellow states and red states?
So I'm on the ATS panel, and I don't think that much. I would recommend Max Mellman's article in the latest issue of the Journal of Law, Medicine, and Ethics about the use of guidelines, and just showing that how they haven't, in a liability context, they haven't don't have a good track record, and he's rather pessimistic about their future there. I guess I should just, and we should talk, but I've painted a rather dismal picture of the red and yellow states, and I think it's important to note that John Luce's research and others have shown that physicians are overwhelmingly successful, right? So just because it's a yellow state or a red state, when they are sued, they almost always win, 99%+ of the time. And I think it would help. I don't think it's going to be a black and white sea change difference. I think, so Amy's going to make an announcement.
Yeah. Yeah, I know our time is running up. Just real quickly, as someone from New York, it's interesting when you think of political context. I've never been referred to as being in a red state. So this is kind of, you know, it's kind of different for me. Who knew? I wonder if we should let Romney know that. But anyway, I just want to let people know a lot of what we've been talking about are themes that will be covered in a lot of sessions, as we've heard. Just a real quick point, we did specifically talk about the Canadian Carter case around physician-assisted suicide, and there was a late-breaking session that was added on Sunday at 9:45 a.m., 1 hour, in Congressional C&D. So if you're interested in hearing more about that case, please, I invite you to come Sunday. I think there's more information at the registration desk as well. But thank you so much for hanging in there with us.
Mark your calendar now for next year's American Society for Bioethics and Humanities annual meeting, coming up October 24th through 27th of 2013 in Atlanta, Georgia. This is a production of Roland Recording.